Hi, Dewa. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you. Would you mind introducing yourself to our listeners?
Sure. Segu Seaguegu. Hello, everyone. My name is Dewa Dariakwa, and I'm Ganyakahaga, which is Mohawk of the Haudenosaunee Confederacy. I'm also a law student and an intern working for Kim's office.
That's great. I am so happy that you are joining us for the first episode of our Guaranteed Livable Income series. You conducted the interview for this week's episode. Would you mind telling us what the interview was about and who you interviewed?
For sure. So I got the opportunity to interview two commissioners from the National Inquiry into Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women and Girls. This inquiry looked into and reported on the systemic causes of all forms of violence against Indigenous women and girls. And so I had a discussion around this concept of guaranteed livable income, which was actually one of their recommendations in their final report. And so I got pretty much their perspective on guaranteed livable income and how it could benefit Indigenous women, but also everybody, all Indigenous peoples and all Canadians.
Thanks so much for doing that interview. Let's listen in.
So before I begin with today's questions, I kind of just want to take a minute to introduce our guests. So Marion Buller, Chief Commissioner Buller is Cree and a member of the Mistawasis First Nation in Saskatchewan. In 1994, Chief Commissioner Buller was the first Indigenous woman appointed as a provincial court judge in British Columbia. Prior to being appointed to the provincial court judge, Chief Commissioner Buller worked in civil and criminal law. Chief Commissioner Buller has lectured and written extensively about Indigenous issues and rights. In 2006, she initiated the First Nations Court in British Columbia. Our other guest, Kaya Robinson. Commissioner Robinson is a graduate of the Akitsirak Law Program, I'm sorry if I mispronounced that, which is a partnership between the University of Victoria and Nunavut Arctic College. Born in Iqaluit and raised in Iqaluit, Commissioner Robinson is a strong Northern advocate who is fluent in Inuktitut and English. Prior to her appointment, Commissioner Robinson was an associate with Borden Ladner Gervais LLP in Ottawa, where she worked on Team North, a multidisciplinary team of 70 lawyers who do a variety of work throughout the northern parts of the provinces and in the territories. Commissioner Robinson has worked on a wide range of issues affecting Indigenous rights. Most recently, she worked as a legal counsel at the Specific Claims Tribunal, traveling to First Nations communities across Canada.
Thank you for having us on the program, and thank you for the kind introduction. I do want to just say that I'm a non-Indigenous woman, non-Inuk, and I think it's very important for me to make that clear, because we have to situate ourselves when we are talking about these types of issues.
So thank you both for agreeing to have this discussion with me today. And so my first question for the both of you is with regards to the work that you've done on the final report and the inquiry. So one of your calls for justice is a guaranteed livable income. Given Indigenous women experience higher rates of victimization and violence, as well as the increased likelihood of being criminalized and imprisoned when they are trying to support and protect themselves and their children from poverty and all forms of violence, how could a guaranteed livable income address the inequality and systemic barriers many Indigenous women face?
Going across the country, we heard from so many people how poverty, and I tend to use the language of economic marginalization as opposed to poverty, how much economic marginalization played a role in either experiencing violence or being put in positions of violence or not being able to leave them. And we also heard a lot about how economic marginalization was a form of violence experienced. You know, I think that if you want to go back historically and even contemporarily, you look at how, you know, starvation and economic denial and oppression played a role in clearing the plains and how reserves were established and and how even treaties were resolved. I'm using air quotes here. So we heard about how economic marginalization played such a role in violence. It also played such a huge role in trauma and played such a role in political agency. And so it was quite clear that in terms of what the root causes of violence were, economic marginalization is one of the four fundamental root causes of the violence. And it's really interconnected, and you can't dissect it away from the political marginalization, from the trauma, compound trauma, intergenerational trauma that has been experiencing and continues. And, you know, those interconnected dynamics and the denial of self-determination, the denial of land, the denial of governance, cultures, laws, structures, families, children, you know, it was also interconnected. So to sort of take all that and to go specifically to the point of guaranteed livable income, I think that addressing that economic marginalization was fundamental when we were looking at what calls for justice or what recourse there was. And, you know, building up the welfare system was clearly not an option. And I think that economists and those with more ABCs behind their names can tell you why. But what I heard was how much those systems themselves were mechanisms of colonial violence. How going to social workers to get help because you're dealing with financial challenges and can't feed yourself meant risking your children being taken from you. And we know this. We know that the vast majority of Indigenous children that are taken from their families are taken for reasons of, and again, air quotes, neglect. And often that neglect is actually poverty, is actually an economic insecurity that makes it impossible for them to meet the needs of their children. Well, their situation and the inability to meet their own needs are because of colonial violence and economic marginalization. So you see that cycle, you see the interconnectedness. So the system as it exists right now and the mechanisms that are used that are really sort of need and merits based and that put you under the microscope of the state that in effect institutionalize you. I think that for many being part of the welfare system, again, air quotes, was very similar to being part of the child welfare system, was being part of the system of corrections and law enforcement. And so it itself, in our recommendations, it was quite clear that we couldn't really prop that up and perpetuate it further. So a guaranteed livable income avoids that, right? It's breaking out of that model. It's also fundamental because it allows for agency and self-determination. And it's also, in my, again, there's people with more ABCs behind their name that can tell you from a psychological perspective, but it's a more trauma-informed way of proceeding in my mind. Because trauma, especially in how trauma compounds itself, is you have no control, you have no agency, you have no choice. And what we learned from experts and knowledge keepers and families and survivors is that helplessness that trauma comes from and that how it perpetuates itself and continues is part of the issue with welfare. So having respect for the agency of an individual and saying, yes, we respect you and your dignity and we want to make sure your basic needs are met, here are the tools for you to do that. For example, guaranteed livable income, that is the more appropriate, humane, and trauma-informed way to proceed. I mean, I could go on and on. I think it also allows for people who've experienced significant trauma to have some time to breathe, to be able to take care of themselves and seek that healing rather than having to worry about food on their plates, right? And then I think about it being valuable in terms of providing and making sure that the needs, fundamental needs of like elders and knowledge keepers and harvesters and medicine people, those people within communities that play such an important role, but they're not recognized in sort of the Canadian economic, system. So, I mean, there are many, many reasons, and I could go on and off and on, and I want to stop. I want to hear from Marion. But those are sort of the things, as we heard going across the country, and the things we came to understand that really resonated with me, that really anchored my understanding of this, and meeting with women in custody did as well. But I'd like to hear more from Marion.
Well, I don't know what to add, because that was such a great response. Just there are a couple of areas I want to highlight and go a little deeper into. What we've done in Canada, for whatever reasons, and we don't need to explore that today, we've criminalized poverty or economic marginalization. And this was abundantly clear and throughout our hearings, pretty much anywhere in Canada on any topic. Because what's happened is we've heard from a lot of people, men and women, that women and girls are forced into prostitution because that's the only way they can get enough money to pay their rent and put food on their table. So we know that prostitution is dangerous in and of itself, but being forced into that because of economic marginalization is just another form of colonization, in my view. Another thing that we heard about from people, again, difficult to kind of parse it out because everything's so interconnected, is that we heard from people who stole from stores, again, because they didn't have enough money to buy baby formula or Pampers or clothes for their kids. This isn't because they're hardened criminals as such, it's because they're poor. And, you know, they're not doing it because they want to, they're doing it because they have to. Again, another form of colonization through economic control. And so what happens is, and we know, a judge is going to sentence somebody for maybe the first four or five offenses to some form of probation. But eventually that person's going to go to jail, not because they're a criminal, it's because they're poor and they're trying to provide for their own families. So we put them in jail. They lose their kids to the foster care system and we're back in that cycle again. So I just wanted to touch on that aspect of the evidence that we heard about criminalizing behavior. Another perspective to take, and that we just kind of touched on in our report, was how poverty and economic marginalization is really a public health issue too. Because we know with poverty, economic marginalization, people don't eat well. They're not properly housed. They don't get the medical attention that they need. So we have the stats. We have lifespans of Indigenous people being shorter than others. We have disease stats that show Indigenous people are more likely to have disease associated with poor diet or respiratory conditions because they're living in bad housing, just as examples. So there are lots of stats that show that this is a public health issue as well. I know some people object to the idea of any form of guaranteed income because they say, oh, it's going to deter people from finding real work,
if that's the proper term. We know that's wrong. The stats don't support that conclusion. But, you know, maybe we have to shift our analysis from work and non-work to a public health perspective.
In light of COVID-19 and the fact that many people do not qualify for the emergency financial supports that have been put into place, do you think that a guaranteed livable income would be a good next and long-term step to assist Indigenous peoples to increase economic autonomy and self-governance?
Well, I'll just start very briefly. If we'd had any form of guaranteed livable income other than for seniors, of course, in Canada, we wouldn't need the COVID programs, would we? You know, but chicken and egg here. So I guess from my perspective, if we learn from COVID, one thing we learn is that we need to broaden our social safety net.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think I'd also add that what we're learning from COVID-19, as much as people will say, you know, COVID-19 is this great equalizer where it sees no race, it sees no, doesn't discriminate. Well, let's look at the impacts. They do. You know, someone with secure income does not need to expose themselves to the virus. They don't need to go to the grocery store. They don't need to continue working. And like, I think about women in the sex trade, sex workers, they don't have a choice. And are they going to tell CBA what the source of their income up until now has been? Like, and so we're seeing that. We're seeing how those marginalized, particularly economically, and from a health perspective as well, are those being hit most, who are suffering not just by, you know, greater exposure to the virus, but also suffering the impacts of a pandemic that grinds everything to a halt. I think that if we had economic policies in line with the guaranteed livable income prior to today, we would have seen exactly what Marion says, where, you know, having to scramble to develop the CERB, don't remember what the acronym stands for, the emergency support for COVID-19, you would have seen more of that bridging. It would have been smoother. You'd also see that different populations weren't excluded from it, right? Like those artists, let's look at that, artists, performers who don't fall under that that system. Again, those who are street involved, those who've been incarcerated, the list goes on, how this patchwork approach to providing economic security during really difficult economic times misses people. And then I think you'd also see that there wouldn't be those concerns from a public health perspective of overcrowded homes, overcrowded shelters, because of the interconnectedness that Marion discussed with public health and poverty, you're seeing that correlation and you're seeing how it plays out. And those are things that could have been prevented. We are seeing the consequences of the people we've left behind, period, as a society. Who we have decided over the years matters and doesn't matter. We're seeing it play out.
Great, thank you for that. How do you believe your work on the inquiry has either helped or reinforced your understanding of the need for economic autonomy and equality for Indigenous women and girls? And what role should a guaranteed livable income play in ensuring this?
Wow. I think the work that we did in the inquiry just simply reinforced a lot of the beliefs based on my own lived experience. As I said earlier, we criminalize poverty, economic marginalization. And I don't know how many times I've had people in court who have said, I stole the Pampers because I couldn't afford, my baby needed them, and I had no other option. It also reinforced my belief that this is as much a way of colonizing people, of keep them poor, keep them on the margins, keep them out of sight, keep them in shelters so we don't have to look at them. It's a continued way to marginalize people, to colonize them. So if we're the country that we say we are, we want to bring people in from the margins. And I think that from my experience as a judge and then also with the inquiry, the only way we're going to do it is to be honest, intellectually honest about what's happening and change and look at a guaranteed livable income for everyone, broaden that social safety net, rather than having bits and pieces here and there, some that contradict each other, some that create tremendous gaps that people fall through. So it just really confirmed what I had believed going into the work. And again, let's be realistic about the situation we're in. Let's listen to the facts and the evidence about guaranteed livable incomes and how they improve people's lives. Let's get away from this sort of Victorian ethic of everybody must work all the time, and if they can't, it's a personal failing on their part. Let's get away from that. Be honest, intellectually honest, and say, okay, let's do this.
Yeah, absolutely. Same as Marian, I think it, a lot of my previous understandings were growing up in Nunavut, where the economic opportunities were so slim. In the community I grew up with, you looked around, the teachers and the nurses and the police and some of the government employees that were there, like public works, were all not from there. So the jobs you could have if you were from there were water truck driver, sewage truck driver, work at one of the two stores. Like, and there's not enough jobs for everybody. So it seemed very, like, it didn't make sense that you would expect everybody to, you know, go to school, do your best, pull up your socks, work hard, you'll make your way in the world. That rhetoric just didn't fit. It didn't jive with the reality. And then I think what really came clear to me in the course of the inquiry was, you know, in line with the reality, what we're dealing with is the result of economic marginalization. I think what I'd echo what Marian has said, but I'd also add, like, when we're looking at a guaranteed livable income, in economic autonomy is really key to self-determination and self-governance individually and for nations. And I think that a guaranteed livable income is a part of that. It's only a part of that. We have to recognize that the marginalization of nations has happened as well as individuals. And so there is needs for reparation. Like, this is, of course, about making sure people's fundamental security rights, as recognized in international and domestic law, are upheld. But we also have to recognize that the situation, as particularly it relates to Indigenous communities, Inuit, Métis, First Nations, is because their wealth and their economies have been stripped from them. So we have to talk about reparations. We have to talk about land. We have to talk about, you know, economic independence and agency, but also reparations in that regard. you know, I think back to the work of the RCAP, the Royal Commission on Aboriginal Peoples, and the reference to the need for nations to be doing their nation building work. And I think that that is echoed in our report, that things have to be Indigenous led and self-determined. But if you are always, as a nation, hamstrung because you're linked to the purse strings of either the federal, provincial government and whatever their agendas are at the moment, and you don't have access to your economic base, your territory, your land, you're relegated to little pockets that, let's face it, were not selected because they were abundant, you know, and you know, we're going to ensure the economic well-being of Indigenous peoples. It was, I've heard families talk about reserves as concentration camps. And I don't, you know, if you look at some of the history, I'm not going to go down that road, but, you know, don't get all mad at me because I've said it. There's a very real lived experience and historic documented reports that talk about the living conditions on reserves and how that was orchestrated. That was deliberate. So we have to, whatever a guaranteed livable income looks like, cannot be excuse to not address those other issues. There is still a significant work. There's still significant work that needs to be done to right to those historic wrongs and to ensure that Indigenous nations have economic security beyond a guaranteed livable income.
So what other services do you believe are needed alongside a guaranteed livable income?
Well, I mean, substantive equity in those services that are purported to be universal and guaranteed right now, healthcare, education, right? And then the expansion of healthcare to recognize mental health, particularly when we're looking at the impacts of trauma, compound, and intergenerational. I think that you know, we don't have the government really looking at health as a right thing, like as a right space thing, and that needs to change. And it, particularly when you look at Indigenous services federally and federal health, like that is not, it's looked at as a program rather than a rights based service. I think that when you look at the calls for justice, we are quite loud in saying there needs to be transformative change in these public services to do exactly that, making them accessible, appropriate, effective, and for there to be substantive equality. So, you know, that Indigenous women and girls and gender diverse people in remote communities like Clyde River have the same access to health care that other Canadians enjoy in other parts of the country, and in their own language and in accordance with their own practices as well. The fact that we still live in a country where, you know, Indigenous children who want to have access not only to the Canadian medical system, but to have their cares also in their traditional way and with their medicines, and they have to go to court for that, is so problematic. So it's really about, I'll say it again, substantive equity in all services.
I agree, Kaya. We heard from so many people the importance of substantive equity, regardless of the subject matter that we were talking or service we were talking about. But I think, you know, we as people sort of examining what needs to be done, I think we have to change our lexicon, and I'm not being critical of anybody, but let's not talk about services. And again, I'm not being critical. It's as Kaya said, we're looking at safe, clean housing, safe, clean water, responsive health care, accessible education, not as services, but these are rights-based programs, if that's a better word, or these are rights-based subject areas. I'm trying to change my own lexicon.
Like it's they're fundamental human rights. They meet people's fundamental human rights and needs.
Yeah, and so
and that's a state obligation.
Yeah,
it's not a service. It's not a perk.
No, and
you're right.
I can totally see that, and I think that these are rights-based programs. Like I wasn't sure what to really call it, but it is something that, you know what, we should have access to this, and we should be entitled to it, but unfortunately we're not. I totally agree with what you said.
Yeah, and it requires that shift, paradigm shift, change in lexicon, and I'm still working on it. That these are fundamental human rights. They're not programs or projects or pilot projects. All the various and assorted titles that we give things, actions, these are human rights. So they involve core funding, core budgeting. People don't have to apply for them on a 3-year application cycle or a 2-year application cycle. People don't have to make sure that their idea of what they want to accomplish fits inside the government pigeonhole of what that money will fund. So we're all learning.
Mm-hmm. You're so right, Marian, and especially on this issue of funding. The fact that Indigenous-led grassroots mental health and trauma care is on a sort of year-by-year a granting cycle, but there's always jails available.
Yes.
The jails are always funded.
Yeah.
Police are always funded. Healing, mental health, Indigenous cultures, Indigenous families, homes, shelters. You have to keep going back for it. Those other services, guaranteed.
Yeah, you have to keep applying.
Yeah.
How many people did we hear from the whole time of the National Inquiry about how they were unable to do full service delivery because of the work involved in filling out application forms, in waiting for government money to arrive? It became the bureaucracy overcame the service delivery.
Mm-hmm. Perfection in bureaucracy versus perfection in service delivery.
Thank you so much. I was very excited for this conversation. I'm very excited to meet you both. And appreciative of all the work that you're doing. Everything you said today was very insightful, and I'm really appreciative to have you guys here with me today. So thank you for that. Hi, Kim. So after hearing from our commissioners, I would like to take this opportunity to get your opinion, your feedback on some important and key themes that I had taken note of. For example, they spoke a lot about economic marginalization, interconnectedness, substantive equality, agency and self-determination, those kinds of things. So I guess I'll just dive right into my first question. So throughout the discussion I had with the commissioners, I noticed that they refer to economic marginalization instead of poverty. They expressed how economic marginalization is a form of violence for many Indigenous women because of the criminalization of poverty. Given the research that you've done thus far on basic income, I was wondering what your thoughts, comments, ideas are on this notion of economic marginalization being a form of violence.
Well, I think it's certainly part of the colonial history that needs to be taken into account. And what I like about their characterization of economic, marginalization versus poverty is it actually situates the problem where I think it lies, which is it's part of a state response. It's everybody who is responsible for setting up the policies around who gets money and who doesn't. If they don't know, they should know what the impact is. And so it situates the responsibility not in the individual as at fault because they are poor, but in the broader context of in a country as rich as Canada, there is no excuse that every person is not housed, clothed, educated, able to fulfill their full potential. And when we talk about Indigenous women and Indigenous peoples in particular, the fact that we not only have those challenges in terms of economic marginalization for Indigenous peoples, we have communities, entire communities that have insufficient water, sanitation. And so, you know, I think it is actually a very important way to recharacterize and something that I will try to remember to do as well and invite you and, you know, all the other amazing folks who work with us in our team to remind me if I forget. Not that it's your job, it's my job to remember, but I'm old and you're young. So if I forget, I invite you to remind me. Let me put it that way. It's not your responsibility.
Great. Thank you. So that kind of also ties into my next question, which is more towards this idea of interconnectedness that they kept mentioning. So during the discussion with the commissioners, they provided some examples of interconnectedness and how human rights-based programs have not been equally distributed to Indigenous communities across Canada. In addition, they emphasized the importance of addressing this ongoing cycle of trauma that continues to impact many Indigenous communities. This trauma that Indigenous people have experienced can be interconnected to the high rates of violence, poverty, lack of housing, inaccessible education, etc. And we know that basic income cannot replace the already existing programs and services available to Canadians because money is not the answer. But how might a basic income kind of reinforce this idea of interconnectedness and ensure that Indigenous peoples have access to the health services, accessible education, food security, all of those kinds of things that they should be entitled to, but are not actually receiving. Sorry.
Okay. No, and I absolutely agree. I think money is not the only answer, but if you have no money, and the biggest challenge is that you can't afford to pay for things, whether it's food, whether it's housing, whether it's clothing, whether it's education, then there are two things. One, we should be making more universally accessible things like dental care, health, and when I say dental, I mean pharma care, dental care, health care, including mental health care. We should be making education more universally accessible. We should be making child care more universally accessible. And we should definitely be putting limits on how much can be charged for rent and really address housing issues. And a basic income is not a substitute for all of those other really important and integral programs. But even if you have all of those programs, it still won't solve the situation of the people who the last thing that they need is to be able to, you know, buy whatever is, you know, as if we've regulated the cost of food, of housing, of education, of any other services. You still need the money to be able to purchase those services at some level, unless we make them all free, which is not likely to be the case. And so, as you know, one of my friends who has dealt with poverty for many, many years said to me once, you know, the problem, what poor people need is money. And if we don't have money, then you can throw all the services in the world at us, but we still, one of the things we need is money. And if we want to really address health issues, then we have to look at what it is that contributes to certain groups having a higher rate of chronic illness, preventable illnesses like diabetes, like heart conditions, that are very much linked to whether they can afford the types of food, whether they have access to the types of living spaces that allow for them to have a more healthy starting point. And we know that the foods that are cheaper are the ones that are, you know, worse for us by and large. And so I think we need to do both. And the idea of a guaranteed livable income, part of the reason many of us have like that wording more than, say, even just a basic income, is because it puts in words that people need enough to live, and it needs to be guaranteed. It's not something that a social worker or a clerk can decide this month you're not entitled because they think you didn't look for work or whatever the guidelines are. And what we've seen during the pandemic that I hope will ensure that more Canadians are alive to and want to see this sort of issue is how many people were so close to the margins who never thought they would be in a situation of requiring state financial assistance, but they did. And as we heard from the Parliamentary Budget Officer when he was testifying before the Senate committees, that if in fact they had had something like a guaranteed livable income before the pandemic, we would not have needed the type of interventions that they had to do with CERB, and it would have cost financially far less, and it would have benefited far more people. So I think it's important that we really examine this and move forward, and at the same time improve the types of programs and improve, actually build, some people are saying rebuild. I don't think we've had it for, you know, universally accessible, adequate health, financial, or social services scheme in this country, if ever, certainly not for the past few decades. But now we have an opportunity to build those. And I think that's really important and what we have to do. And I think the commissioners and the questions you asked them really underscored that. So good work, Dewa.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Appointed. Please stay tuned for the next episode of our Guaranteed Livable Income series.